Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey everybody, this is Angela. We're excited to bring you our podcast today, but before I begin, I just want to make sure that you're all planning to join us at the NACC conference that is scheduled for August 24th through the 28th. The conference this year is virtual, and we'll certainly miss the camaraderie that we have when we all get together, but there's some really great benefits to a virtual conference. First of all, you don't get faced with that problem of wanting to go to two sessions that you can't attend at the same time. The sessions are spread out, so you can attend as many as you want in person, and also you'll have access to the content for the entire year. So if there's one you really love and you want to go back and hear it again, it'll be right there. Also, if you're not a member of the NACC, this is a great time to join. The NACC is doing a spectacular job of providing resources. They have lots of member webinars and a lot of COVID resources. So in any event, we will put a link in the show notes to the NACC website and the conference page, and we hope to see you there. And now for the podcast. Hey, everybody. This is Angela Orkin, and I'm here with John and Jim. And today we're talking with Dr. Jessica Price. She is the director of the Florida Institute for Child Welfare, and she is also at the Florida State University College of Social Work. Welcome, Dr. Price.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we're looking forward to this conversation today. And we have lawyers from all over the country that are listening in and are impacting children's lives through legal advocacy every day. And so we really wanted to have a conversation about overrepresentation of Black children in the child welfare system, but also implicit bias and some of the things that we all need to be aware of in our advocacy. And so I thought it might be interesting to start out with just a little bit of, I know you've done tons of research on this, but some of the basic statistics on overrepresentation of Black children in child welfare.
Sure. So around the country, it is widely known that African-American kids take up upwards of 34 to 35% of the foster care population, but their population in general is around 14%. So in many states, they're two times more likely to be separated from their families. Frankly, in other parts of the country, it's even higher than that. So we also know that other families of color are overrepresented as well. So Hispanic children in some municipalities around the country are 3 to 4 times more likely. I know that there is an area of the country where Native American children are 16 times more likely to be separated from their families. So it really depends on where you are in the country, but those are some general kind of statistics around how kids of color are faring as it relates to family separation.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's so much conversation across the country now. And I think a lot of people, when you talk about the child welfare system, when you hear the word racism, people just pause and think, well, that's not possible. This is not, you know, so many people are in here to do good. I think a lot of people don't really understand the difference between overt racism and implicit bias and how that impacts decision making. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So implicit bias is that automatic and unconscious system that's in all of us, and it informs our decisions. I tell people often that usually your implicit bias is totally counter to what you say verbally regarding your beliefs, because again, it's this automatic thing that comes up in everyone. And implicit racial bias is largely informed by systemic and structural racism. So that's really kind of in a nutshell how I define implicit bias.
And, you know, I know you do a lot of research in this area in the child welfare system, because, you know, I think people make the assumption that if you were Black, you wouldn't have an implicit bias against a Black family versus a white family. Do you find that to be true?
So, yes, I will quote Dr. Alan Detlaff. He is a professor in Texas, and his research looked at that. He found that Black children were more likely to be assessed at higher risk, and their cases were more likely to be verified. And this happened with white caseworkers as well as Black caseworkers.
And I think I want to refer our audience to your TED Talk, which is amazing because it does present. I think a lot of times we talk about these issues and we're like grasping for solutions. So what do we do? The TED Talk is called To Transform Child Welfare, take race out of the equation. I wonder if you could just tell our audience, you know, briefly what you talked about in the TED Talk with the blind removal process.
Sure. So I used to work in New York, and I was able to be a part of a project, and my responsibilities was traveling around New York State to different areas, small little counties around rural New York State. And I ended up stumbling upon Nassau County and started to really investigate and analyze what they had been doing to impact their disparity numbers, because they saw the data and wanted to do something about it. So they did a myriad of strategies, but the one that was perhaps the most notable, more innovative, was redacting demographic information about the family before the decision to separate ever happened. And that's known as blind removal meetings, where a caseworker does their initial assessment, they go out, they meet the family, but when they come back, they sit in a room with a committee and talk about everything, but they don't mention race, they don't mention neighborhoods or anything like that. And the committee decides that day if the child is put in foster care. And the research that I did, you know, and I talked about in the TED Talk, it was able to decrease the number of Black kids going into care by nearly 50%. And I think that was just really eye-opening for a lot of people. And a lot of people are interested in blind removals, but I do know that there are some limitations, and I'm learning as we go as well with blind removals and how it's implemented at different places.
I'm curious, did the overall number of removals go down?
Yes, I often tell people that it decreased disproportionality and nullified the disparity that happens, but across the board, there were less removals. And ultimately, that's the goal.
Any other impacts of it, unexpected impacts of that process?
Well, I think one of the biggest impacts outside of those numbers was the awareness that happened in the workforce. So before they implemented blind removals, they did a lot of trainings and self-awareness, but there was still a little pushback when they decided to implement blind removals, which is normal. People said, I'm not a racist. I don't need to redact. I don't need to blind this process. But I think after looking at the data, people were amazed that they impacted it at that caliber. And I think it just shows you that, like I said, that implicit bias comes up unbeknownst to us.
Dr. Price, if I could just jump in on that, because I find it really interesting that I love the blind removal method and the thing they did there, because it's like, it's beyond training, right? Because there's a lot of conversations now in our jurisdiction about, well, we need more training, you know, and there's some excellent trainings out there. Like the Racial Equity Institute, I've heard is a really good 2-day workshop. But just training people, it doesn't seem like it's going to be enough, because on some level, you're not going to change people's behavior with a 2-day training, and you're not going to change the world we live in with a 2-day training. You need like something like this blind removal method, which is more like a check on the system, right? It's like a conscious stop point or a choke point where everyone has to stop, and we are forced to remove the bias, like physically remove it, as opposed to training. And I just see so many places now that I'm afraid that the reaction now is going to be, well, let's train everyone. Let's train the racism out of people. And I don't know if that, I think that's what we've been doing for the last 20, 30 years. And I don't see any change in the data, really.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I talk about blind removals a lot. And I always get someone who is opposed to it. You know, I have some people saying, what's not to like about this? But, you know, some people are not advocates for blind removals, and their main thing is what you just said. They say, we're not getting to the root of racism. And all I can respond to that is, you're right. You know, this is not eradicating racism. It's nullifying the impact of someone's implicit racial bias, which is informed by racism. So you're absolutely right.
That's what we're wrestling with both in our delinquency and our dependency systems, is that the racial bias in the delinquency system starts at the point of arrest, and the racial bias in our child welfare system starts arguably at the point of the phone call to the abuse registries, the doctors, the teachers. But I work within the court system. And so any little influence I have begins at the courtroom door. And so if I want to make my little world better, I have to concentrate on what I can impact and what I can affect. And if I'm not going to be as effective, I'm still going to do things like march in the streets and write my senator. But in terms of working in my field where I can do it, I can try to stop the overcommitment of juvenile delinquents. And I can try to stop the long staying of children in foster care or the removal to foster care as opposed to placing with kinship, the disproportionate impact there. So that's what I like about it is, I mean, I tend to think that, yeah, if all we do is train on trying to remove the we're not going to get anywhere. We're still going to, 20 years from now, we're going to still be seeing these biases in our systems.
Yeah. And I like to tell people that things happen so much earlier than when they get into child welfare, our system, like you said, educators and their biases, healthcare professionals. You know, a study came out, a research paper just came out this month, so 2020, where they were uncovering this idea of over-surveillance of Black families, over-surveillance of impoverished families of color, where there's so many eyes on them, and there could be someone in the public with a level of bias that's impacting them. So when they come into our child welfare system, in my opinion, blinding that process is essential because racism very well may have brought them in.
It's a great point. I'm wondering if you've seen other counties successfully replicate that, the blind removal process, and see the numbers come down in that way.
Great question. No, I have had several counties ask me, you know, how do we implement it? Can you help us? Can you train us? And they have started that process, but I haven't seen any data just yet. But I'm looking forward to what they found and how it's working and how it's uncovering awareness in their workforce. I also tell people that I realized this year that blind removals may be limited as it relates to larger areas. So I was contacted by LA County, and as you probably know, if it's not the largest, it is one of the largest child welfare systems in the country, where at a given moment, they have 35,000 open cases. So the idea of a blind removal meeting is just not feasible for LA County. So I think it's important for people to realize that you're gonna have to be amenable and adapt this process. I still believe in redacting information, but that can happen over the phone. It can happen when you're talking to an attorney. It can happen when you're talking to your supervisor. It doesn't have to happen in a room formally like Nassau County.
Right, and let me ask, is there still some value in training? I'm thinking of what happens once we get past removal and we're in the courtrooms. And I'm thinking of some of the implicit bias and the impacts it has on the system there. We're trying to change systemic racism. So it seems to do that, you need to change the system and not just train the individuals. But as an individual who's moving from I'm not a racist to oh no, I might be a racist. You know, I mean, I have, and I never would want to go review decisions I made as a 27, 28 year old attorney. I think I might keep myself up at night thinking about the implicit bias that might've been baked in. But I'm wondering, is there still some value in training in the system once kids come into the court system and families come into the court system? Or do we need to be creative with some kind of systemic change like the blind removals that you've come up with for the beginning part of the system? Do we need to do something systemic to really change decisions, whether to terminate someone's rights or whether to commit a delinquent child? Because we do trainings and we do studies in our county and jurisdiction, and the judges say, looks like the judges are going to get blamed for the commitments. Looks like, you know, the Department of Children and Families will get blamed for filing too many terminations. So it's a question for us going forward.
Yeah, it's a great one. So I'm going to say, yes, there's still room for training, but I don't think that should be it. And like what you said earlier, people train and they think they're done. But training is literally step one. You know, it's important to have a unified understanding of implicit bias, a unified understanding of systemic racism, get that out there. And then let's move to systemic change and evolve our system and change it. I also don't know if you've heard of so many movements around the country where they're saying we are beyond reform. It's what you're saying. We can we change the system, or do we need to upend it and build a new one that works for all families? So again, I do think training has a place, but it's the reality of it is right now the system is riddled with racism, and either we have to build a new system or, like you said, start to really be intentional about changing policies and practices and strategies and mandating those, not just suggesting them.
Well, I wonder, you know, I'm brainstorming as we're talking, because the blind removals is just a clear point in time, but I'm wondering if there wouldn't be an opportunity when there's like a children's law office, and like John and Jim's office does a great job of these, what do you call it, the reviews, just case reviews, quarterly case reviews, you know, when there's going to be kind of a big decision, if a supervisor might present it to a supervisor without the demographic data, what your recommendations, you know, what's gone on in the case and what the recommendations are. I don't know. I mean, maybe there is a place for checking yourself by presenting the facts to someone else and leaving that out. I don't know.
I believe there is, you know, the medical field is obviously already doing blind medical trials, you know, trying to, you know, not trying to look at the patient or know anything about the patient, but focusing on the medicine. About 2 years ago, they started blind charging in California, where a prosecutor could not hand down a charge unless the information that was given to him was totally redacted and information about demographics weren't there. So I agree with you. I think it can happen there. I've gotten so many phone calls that say, you know, can this happen in the education realm? You know, there's an issue right now with marginalized Black children getting suspended in pre-K and getting suspended from daycare. You know, so can you modify a process where if you think a child should be suspended, you staff it with your supervisor, redact information? You know, is that going to help not send a Black child home for 10 days and or home forever? So I think in multiple places, this can be useful.
We'd like to give the lawyers some specific strategies and things that they can do to check themselves. Do you have any ideas on that front?
Yes, I do. So related to when I was in the field, I recall staffing cases with attorneys, and because they were focused on maybe not winning or not having enough evidence, they were kind of digging for evidence, if that makes sense. You know, they were asking certain questions, they were asking leading questions, trying to figure out, do we have enough to take this child, or is that enough to get this child out of the home? So I would say, as a number one strategy, approach discussions like that with what they approach blind removals with, focusing on three things. What happened to the child? Observable, concrete facts. You know, what is the family strength and capacity and resilience? And then the third thing is, what's the relevant history? Because we all know that not all history is relevant to the decision of family separation. So I always tell the judiciary and judges and attorneys to come in with a different posture. We can walk out of here with the judge saying, you don't have enough, and it's okay. But I don't think attorneys, at least when I was in the field, they wanted to leave a courtroom without that happening. Another thing I would say is listen to parents. I remember sitting in courtrooms and nobody listened to parents. Nobody paid much attention to them. It was very much, we're here for a reason. You showed up to advocate for your child, but we're not going to take what you say and really try to change our decision, or it's not going to impact what we're doing. So strategy number two, listen to parents. And the third thing I will say is advocate for quality counsel for parents, because we didn't do that. And I might have mentioned to you, Angela, that I have a great friend in the Bronx. And she does, all she does is provide counsel for parents who've lost their kids, minority parents, because it's hard to get quality counsel out there who care about listening to them and what they've gone through.
I'm wondering, one of the things that came to my mind, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on it, was one of the leading causes of dependency seems to be kind of a lack of support for the family or for the mother or the father, whoever the parent may be. So often a family comes in and with a little more structural support in the community or the family, that maybe we could avoid removal, but it's just not there, so we remove. And I'm wondering if you think some kind of a pre-removal, you know, focusing more energy, more funds on pre-removal services is a helpful thing that could impact our disparate outcomes later on?
I do. And I get this question a lot too. People raise their hands in trainings that I'm in and they say, well, I remove kids because the services that would keep them together don't exist, or they're not eligible, or there's not enough, their waiting lists are too long. And that's a really tough and sad situation, that we're separating kids because we don't have the services to keep them together. So that to me is an admittance that the child is not in danger, that if the parents got help, then they would be stable. So I completely agree. You know, a good friend of mine recently said online that we need to defund family separation and pre-fund prevention. So absolutely right. We need to get funding at the beginning of this entire process. I also want to talk about a piece of research. I know we are over the research question, but I am a researcher. Just last year, Dr. Bywater, he's a scholar, and he found that even when you controlled poverty, because a lot of people say it's not racism, it's poverty. But he did a study where he controlled for poverty, and that didn't impact the fact that he still found that Black children received less supportive services than white children. So, you know, people can say continuously, you know, we take kids because they're poor, but the research is showing that people take kids because they're Black or because they're Hispanic, and we have preconceived notions about Black parents in this country and Hispanic parents, Native American parents.
And can I ask this too? Because, I mean, as we talked about this with our staff, the conversation just organically went to staff saying, well, you know, for our Guatemalan community, we have this one service provider that's just excellent, that just understands them, can speak all of the dialects, and can help us reunify these Guatemalan families where we just couldn't do it until we found this provider. And for our Haitian families, we've got this one agency we refer to, and they can seem to motivate these parents and get them to understand what this system is about and what they have to do to get their children back. Our Black families and our white families go to the same service providers. And so I'm just wondering, you know, obviously blind removals is one thing at the front end of the system, but once you're in the system and you have to do a case plan and here's your services, I'm wondering if there's a disadvantage there, if we should have community-based services that are tailored to the Black community, like, for instance, we have organically developed for the Haitian community and the Guatemalan community in our jurisdiction. Is that something that might be helpful?
I'll start off by saying yes. I'm sure that there will be a benefit to having your provider network, your mental health professionals of a diverse background, so that they match the demographics of the clients that they see. So I don't think that that is a negative thing. But I will say that it's rare. You know, it's not common to have this equal amount of, like you said, you know, Haitian, a therapist of Haitian descent, or a therapist who's African American, and a therapist who's white, of all equal percentage around certain counties and states. So I usually tell people that the training and the awareness and the implicit bias work can't be just in our child welfare system. We have to leverage and bring in our community partners, our teachers, our law enforcement. I did a training a few months ago, and the chief of police was in this training with child protective investigators. So we have to bring everyone to the table, because again, if we don't have the matching demographics for therapy, but let's say we have a white therapist and a Black child, but that white therapist has been inundated with understanding about systemic racism and implicit bias and how it impacts their work with this child and their family, I think that goes a long way as well if we can't do the matching. But I do hear you, and I'll have to say that would be probably ideal, but just not, it's all not always the case.
And back to just what you said earlier about upending the system, there are people who want to, who think that the system needs to be defunded and rebuilt from the ground up. And I can understand that, because it really is a system that's built, it's a system built by white people. And Jim and I have heard this throughout our career with the push towards adoption since the Adoption and Safe Family Act, is that people have told us adoption is a white construct almost, is that is being forced on on Black families in a way through the Adoption and Safe Families Act, pushing adoption. That's the second goal: reunification, then adoption, then kinship care and relative placement. But is that a point of frustration or a point of conflict that is going to keep us from resolving cases in a better way for Black children, which is, would be maybe being raised by kin and not having to, well, I'm going to choose the foster parents to adopt this child instead of the kin, because the kin is not going to pass an adoption home study. I could place the child there with a 2-page relative home study and then go permanent guardianship and leave the child there and let her grow up with her auntie or her grandmother. But the goal is adoption. The child's young. She's only 3. Let's let her be adopted by the foster parents that she's been placed with, because they can adopt, they can pass a home study. Is that a source of underlying a fundamental flaw in our system that is really producing racially disparate outcomes, perhaps? Is that it's written by white people with white people ideas of how children should be raised?
Yes, I would agree with that. And I would say that this is really the most heartbreaking part of my job, to hear moms call me who have had their parental rights terminated. And obviously that's supported by ASFA. I know a lot of colleagues that have been working tirelessly for a decade trying to repeal that legislation. So it is very problematic for Black families. And in my opinion, it's problematic for all families. But I agree with you. There are systemic issues that incentivize adoption because of how the system is set up. Like you said, caseworkers will say, I don't have time to prepare this kinship family or prepare their home or do a home study. I have a foster family already ready to go. We should never have a system that bogs down caseworkers so much they choose family separation because they don't have enough time or energy left to do a thorough and adequate job. So I would say yes, ASFA is a point of frustration. It is heartbreaking. Like I said, people have called me and said, I lost my kids. I've been trying to get them back. I have grandparents that have called me and said, my daughter or my son, you know, got TPR. They lost their parental rights. And in some cases, they were struggling through addiction and they weren't able to provide for their child. But I have grandparents that are saying, I tried my best to show up, and my grandchild is being raised and adopted by someone else. That's a heartbreaking thing to hear. And they're fighting. And I'm not a lawyer. I'm not, you know, attorneys. And I tell them, I'm not a lawyer, but what I try to do is elevate their voices. I try to publish and get their stories out there. And hopefully people are so moved that they try to, you know, help out. But to me, again, attorneys might have this answer. I don't know how long it might take to overturn a TPR, overturn adoptions. I mean, that sounds really hard to do. But I'm telling you, families are trying.
It is hard. And actually, one way we've come around it in our careers is we have actually had biological parents adopt their own children. Yeah. So it's like a tricky way around it. If a person has rehabilitated themselves, and we've had clients who are sitting in foster care not being adopted, and here comes biological mom. Or sometimes we seek out biological mom to say, well, let's see where she's at now. You know, it's been 3 years or 4 years. Let's see how she's doing, you know. And we found them, and they've got their lives together, and we've actually had people adopt their own children. So that's been a good outcome. But I guess what led to my question was, we have the Indian Child Welfare Act in this country, and we keep Native American families, we try to keep them together. We don't do a very good job of it, but we do it, you know, on paper. We're supposed to be doing a better job of it. But being raised in multi-generational families, being raised by kin, that's all part of how Native American children are raised. And we seem to give that more respect, but the Black community is just completely assimilated into this white construct of child welfare law and child welfare system. Whereas I'm noticing, like, my Guatemalan community is being treated differently. My Haitian community is being treated differently. We don't have a big Native American population, but I see nationally they get treated respectfully, they don't get treated respectfully at all. But on paper, we have a system designed, and there is some lip service given to treating them respectfully. But our Black community is completely assimilated into the child welfare system and expected to, and we don't really carve out anything to respect how they think their children should be raised. It's all the laws that we have already written, and you must conform to those laws.
And they also haven't, and when I say they, I'm thinking the powers that be, also haven't given thought to how systemic racism, we know this, it doesn't just impact foster care, it impacts housing, it impacts employment, it impacts education. So to not take into consideration, you know, historically how Black families and what they've had to endure, you know, when a Black family comes to your door, and I say child welfare's door, you have to understand historically what that family has gone through, what they've endured, and the trauma that they're carrying. I mean, research shows that there is trauma intergenerationally because of slavery, and people don't understand that there are remnants of that type of, you know, vicarious trauma that people are dealing with, even in contemporary times. So I agree with you. There isn't anything like that. You might have heard in Minnesota, they were trying to pass state legislation called the African American Family Preservation Act. It did not pass. I know the champion for that bill. They're going up again for the third year, trying again, but it would be landmark, because you're right. There hasn't been, you know, a state or federally where they say, this is what we're doing for African-American families to try to keep them together and keep them well.
And it seems like it's maybe time for a step like that, because the system so disproportionately affects the Black community and Black children in our nation that it almost seems like it's time for a specialty court or something designed to address this problem on a systemic level, because it is such a big system. And John said earlier that the system kind of grew up in an organic way, or was built. And I think built is too complimentary. It kind of grew like a weed, really, the system, right? Out of need. It just kind of grew like a weed, and this is what we're left with today. But there wasn't a lot of design or thought really put into the way we take care of children in need.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I will also say that, you know, poverty and these standards that have been created, you know, within child welfare are often conflated with bad parenting. You know, if you don't meet this standard, if you don't have this much money, you're a bad parent. And I think that's a big issue for Black mothers too. They don't look the part, and they're not doing certain things that other moms are doing. You know, I've had a mom from New York, you might've read her story, but her 3 or 4 year old walked out of their home while the mother was taking a bath. Her daughter was napping. She woke up and walked outside. And the next thing that happened was a CPS case was called. And the headline of the article, I think it said, if this happened in a white neighborhood, somebody would have got the child, walked home and said, you know, and brought her back home and checked in. Nobody would have picked up the phone and called CPS. So those types of things are just, you know, extremely sad and extremely racist.
It's just true. In Westchester County, Officer Friendly picks up the child and likely returns the child.
Well, that actually kind of brings me back to one other question I wanted to ask related to our audience. And so if someone's listening to this and is thinking, huh, you know, maybe I do need to kind of look into my own implicit biases, what would you recommend that they do? How do they go about that absent, you know, a specific training on the topic?
So if it's not about training, I always recommend being able to talk about this with coworkers and supervisors, because I think that we have to have a level of safety and level of comfort in talking about things that are tough and saying, you know, I'm working on a case and I'm feeling this, I might need a little assistance. You know, there were cases that I had when I was in the field where I knew I had to stop and get some assistance because I was having way too much of a reaction and I knew it was more about me. So I think we have to be more attuned to ourselves and, you know, talk to our peers, talk to our supervisors about our bias. I also, again, I just believe that as it relates to attorneys and judges and the judiciary, we have to ask ourselves how we would respond if the family was of a different race. I don't know if you're familiar with a project that happened in the Bronx called Bench Cards. And they did a small pilot project where the judges had a card on their bench and it said, would you have made the same ruling if this family was white? if you've made this same ruling, if this family was a different color. And they were asked to make a ruling, look at that, and just, you know, in conjunction, consider that. And it was really eye-opening. Some of them are really forthright and transparent by saying, you know, I had to stop in my tracks sometimes and say, if this family was white, I think I would have pushed the caseworker or asked more questions instead of just handing down a ruling. I don't know how that might transfer into, you know, with attorneys and lawyers, but that was a really small way to stop us and slow down the process. And I'm a big advocate for slowing down the process of family separation. It should not be a fast thing.
No, I think that's a great one, like for us to add to our own case review process is, you know, when we come to the end of a case review, we've made recommendations to this, add that question. Okay, wait, would we have done this if this family were white? Because my staff is painfully aware of the different treatment white families and white children get in court from black families. Everyone sees it and has always seen it. The level of attention, the level of detail, the level of trying. And so I think that's a great question to add to everyone's case review process. And it's the kind of stop and think moment that I think like the checkpoint that we need that goes beyond just training. That's what I think one big takeaway for our audience should be, is you're not going to train this out of you. Don't count on yourself to control your own behaviors because you're living in a biased world that is, you're not stronger than the biased world you are living in. No matter how strong you think you are, no matter how good a person you think you are, you cannot overcome the implicit bias of this system and this planet that we're living on, this country that we're living on right now. You're just not going to be able to do it by yourself.
And I also would add that, you know, African Americans may very well show up in a certain way that makes other people standoffish. And what I mean by that is the attorney I mentioned in the Bronx, she is a white woman. And she says when she sits in front of a client, they're angry, they're mad, they're not happy, they're not saying nice things. And she usually says, I know you're angry. I know what I represent. I know, you know, I'm here to help you, but all you see is a, you know, the white woman who came and took your kids. So I would just also recommend to people that even if they're rebuffed, just try to have some cultural sensitivity and put on your racial equity lens and understand why that anger, it's not anger towards you, it's anger towards systemic racism, something that's so elusive that nobody can touch it. They just feel it. And so as an attorney, as the judges see families and how they're behaving or their attitudes, I've seen that as a caseworker. A mom comes in, she's really angry, and that impacts a decision. You know, they see that and they make a determination about her demeanor. So I think that that's a really good thing to do. I also wanted to add, Angela, that, you know, you also said what kind of ideas to put across or what levels of advocacy that I could add. And I would say that reframing certain things in our system is really important. I love that the theme of this podcast has been kind of beyond training, but I also want people to realize that there is a reframing of foster care to stranger care. And when you start thinking about foster care as stranger care, I think it illuminates the idea that we take a child from their parents, usually unjustifiably, and we place them with strangers, and we think that's okay. Like, it's amazing how we've created this thing that is okay to do, but it's really not when you think about it. And it's extremely traumatic to have a family separated. And as an attorney who knows this information now, I think when they have a part of that decision or when they come into the fold, they can bring this information to the rest of that process.
Well, this has been incredibly helpful. I appreciate so much your time and for joining us today. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is going to give the lawyers out there in the field some new ideas and some concrete things that they can do. So thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you all.
You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.